Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and the parts of Iowa that aren't underwater are in bloom and beautiful. Planting season is upon us, and it's a great time to take action to prevent some of the common disease and pest problems that can plague your garden through the growing season. With me today, Laura Iles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Hello, Laura.
Good morning, Charity.
And Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, plant pathologist and diagnostician with the clinic. Hello, Lena.
Hello.
Thank you both for being here. Richard Giron's going to join us in just a few minutes. But you guys hear a lot about the problems that develop in people's yards and gardens throughout the season. And right now is a great time to get ahead of that and think about what you can do to prevent some of those problems. So before we plant, what should we be thinking about?
Well, now that we have all this plant cells that people are excited about, one thing would be right plant on the right location. You know, we don't want things that will get diseases if they're planted in the shade. Think of what plants fit the landscape better and the varieties that you'll be planting.
All right. So make sure that you have the right plant for the right location. If you're not sure how to do that, I know that Iowa State University Extension has a lot of resources that you can turn to. But you can also talk to somebody at the nursery center, right?
Yes, people at the nursery center should be happy to help, like what kind of yard you have, maybe what your soil type is. You know, and think about, you know, when you're purchasing a plant, how large you want it to be, you know, those sorts of things. So they should be able to provide lots of help for that.
All right. And when you're buying those plants, we go to the nursery center, we get a little excited. Some of us just start buying things. Should we be looking really carefully at the plants that we're buying to make sure that we're not bringing a disease into our garden?
Yes, absolutely. Looking at the leaves. Maybe if they are dry enough, you can see the root systems. And from my own experience of going out and buying plants and getting in a frenzy, I think I enjoy, you know, take a little bit of time pre-buying where you can have a plan on what plants you want and what locations. Do they need to be full sun, part sun? And if you have had any problems in the past, then you may be looking at different varieties that will fit that. Or even a different host that will not get that particular problem in that location.
All right. So be careful about what you bring into your environment. There are a lot of developments in different plants. As you were mentioning, maybe get a plant that is disease resistant. So is that something that you can find out if you just read the little tag on the plant, or do you need to do your research before you head to the garden center?
I would say you need to do a little bit of research. Not all of them have in the tag what they need. Most often when you're buying seed, you can find the traits and the different things that the variety will come with. But I think when you go into the potted plants, those tags may not have a lot of information. So it would be great advice to try and make a plan ahead of time and decide on a variety.
All right. Now, of course, we talk about this on Horticulture Day all the time. Richard has taught us well that we are supposed to rotate our crops in the garden. Give us a little rule of thumb about how we need to do that and how far away from a previous location we need to get if we're really rotating.
Well, and that, you know, definitely for the vegetable garden, you want to make sure that you're planting different families, so you don't want to have tomatoes and eggplants and peppers and then this year do the same. You know, think about, you know, your kale or your brassicas in general and put them this time where the tomatoes used to be. Or if you have, you know, I have a couple of sweet corns that I like to put, and I like to put them in different places. So kind of think of the plants that they belong to the same family and rotate so that they're not, you know, building up problems in that location.
All right. And I know that a lot of us have limited space, so that can be a real problem. You know, I want to have my tomatoes, but I have a small plot of land. What do you do if you can't really rotate?
Well, I have tried containers and I had in my garden built a bed that is a little deeper. And so I kind of rotate there my basil, then tomato, then other herbs and things. And, you know, if you can sometimes let follow, or for example, this year on that bed, I'm just doing flowers. So you can be creative and make it fun too.
All right. And you really have to do it, though.
Yes, please.
All right. Because I think a lot of us do try to talk ourselves out of having to make that rotation because we just don't have enough space. All right. So how about timing? Because we also get really eager when the sun starts to shine and the temperature gets warm. Do we need to be careful about when we put things in the ground?
I would say so, especially some of those crops that, you know, if you're thinking of an insect, my best example is cucurbits. I try to plant my cucurbits thinking of the different conditions. And if I had years of bacterial wilt and, you know, if it's warm enough or I can cover them, maybe I'll start them once, you know, there's not a lot of them. But once a lot of the beetles start to come up, I kind of quit because I know that they will be dying pretty quickly from that bacteria that the beetle will carry into my cucurbits.
Now, another thing that I think a lot of us run into is we get a lot of plants and then we get out to the garden and have that limited amount of space. And we think maybe we'll just squeeze the plants in. So let's talk about plant spacing. We all have guidelines on that, but it's easy to violate those rules. How important is that?
Oh, it's so important, especially for pathogens, because if you crowd a lot of those plants and we have a little bit of dew in the morning or humidity and rain, you know, that humidity is going to build up and pathogens love that. And so you may, you know, end up with a really bad case of a lot of disease on those areas.
Okay, so we actually have to follow directions. when we start fertilizing, it's also really rewarding to see that growth take off and that deep flush of green. Is over-fertilization a problem?
Absolutely, and I think especially with some of the soil-borne pathogens, when you put a lot of nitrogen in different nutrients, then the pathogen has a lot of easier way to get into the plants, and so it's going to cause problems a lot faster, too.
All right, let's talk about some of the things that we need to do after planting. Mulching can keep down weeds. Does it also help you out with the disease problems sometimes?
Well, I think it's all about the source of the mulch. And I think one of my main concerns is when trees that were diseased happen to be chipped and then that mulch will return into the soil. And if that mulch potentially is contaminated with, like, for example, verticillium, then you can be moving this pathogen in the soil. So that's one of my big recommendations is if you ever think that you have a problem, a tree, a woody plant that may be suffering from verticillium, make sure that you get it diagnosed properly and then decide if you want to chip it or not, because you don't want to be moving those chips. The verticillium fungal structures are very tiny and they will stay alive for a while. And so when you move that mulch, then you're introducing that pathogen to that area.
We use tomato cages. We use other kinds of stakes and trellises and things like that. And that, of course, can keep our plants from breaking or having trouble. But it can also really help with disease management, can't it?
Absolutely. You know, again, that idea of training those plants so that there is a lot of airflow and that helps that humidity stay down, that's great.
When we water our plants, are there ways that we can water to reduce risk?
Oh, yes, and it's so easy. I think if you just focus your attention on going at the base of the plant, water deeply as opposed to overhead watering. Because when you do overhead watering, a lot of the water ends up on the leaves and creating like the perfect splashing opportunity for pathogens, but also humidity that is perfect for, you know, those pathogens to get into the plant.
All right, now here's where things start to get away from a lot of us. We get everything planted, things start growing, and then they really, really start growing. So as things are developing and maybe even ripening, what do we need to do to keep up with what's going on in the garden?
Well, I think it's important to look at your plants often. You know, part of it is the enjoyment of looking at them, but also trying to find any problems that may arise quickly. The earlier you find a problem, the best chances you have at, you know, keeping it under control.
All right. Now, let's say we do develop problems, which so many of us do. How do we figure out how to respond?
It really depends on the problem. You may have something that is just cosmetic, and it, for example, it may not affect the fruit production or the fruit look, and in case of tomatoes, for example, or something that may be deadly. So it really depends on what is the problem. And that's where the identification, like proper diagnosis, is really important.
All right. And if you don't already have that in your brain, how do you diagnose the problem?
Well, there's a lot of different resources. We always advise, you know, sharpen your observation skills, look at the whole plant if possible. We can help you a lot in the clinic. You know, if you go to our website, we have a lot of photos and different information on how to look at trees, look at plants in general. And if after you've done your detective job on your own, you want help from us, we'd love to help you out to make sure, especially with those cases of problems that are very serious and that you have to be, you know, right on those.
All right. And when things get so bad that you can't figure out what's going on, maybe you've even called Horte and we haven't been able to answer your question. How do people take advantage of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic services? How can people get you to take a look at what's going on in their garden?
Right. Well, you can call us. Our phone number is 515-294-0581. And lots of people email us pictures and then send samples. A lot of times it's nice to call and get information about how to send a sample. They just come in the mail. We recommend people send them early in the week. And so they get there and then we can take a look at that sample. If you send later in the week, sometimes they sit over the weekend in the mail and plants don't do too well in the mail in the heat over the weekend.
So I'm sure that the two of you have been through enough seasons that as things shape up, you start to predict the kinds of problems you're going to hear about. It's been a really wet spring. What is your radar telling you about this year?
So far, we've been getting primarily the conifers in. Conifers are one of the first things. I think people, when they get out in their yard, when it starts to get nice, those are the first thing. They're still green from the winter, so they start to take a look and notice any, you know, dying from either winter burn or things like that, you know, brown needles. So that's what we're seeing right now. And the wet weather for a lot of the diseases and things, depending on the timing and when, you know, it's producing those spores, you know, sometimes we have bad years and sometimes not, but it is hard to predict. And it does, oftentimes we're surprised by, you know, the disease, but they tend to hit really quickly and over a few week period, it's like a ton of samples of something.
All right. With me, Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, and Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, plant pathologist and diagnostician with the clinic. Richard Giron is going to join us in a moment, and they are all here to answer your questions. So give us a call, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. With 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, I have Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, and Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, plant pathologist and diagnostician with the clinic. And also joining us now, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And boy, it is beautiful out there. I think it's a particularly good year, at least from my perspective here in southeastern Iowa, for red bud trees. And it feels like everything has burst into bloom all at once. Is this kind of an unusual convergence, or am I just really excited?
Not so much, I don't think. I think we're a little bit behind this year as compared to other years. The red buds should be in full bloom this weekend, early next week. Most of the crab apples, I think, should be in full bloom by next weekend in central Iowa.
All right. And it is spectacular. Hopefully we get some more sunny and dry days to really take advantage of these beautiful blooms and hopefully no storms to blow them all away. We have a lot of people with questions already, so we'll get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We'll start with Anne in Waverly. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I am calling because every year I seem to get this fungus on my squash plants, that summer squash, my winter squash, and my cucumbers. I've changed locations in the garden, and I've got a very big garden, so they're a good 15, 20 feet in a different direction, and it always seems to come up, even when I've tried planting at different times, planting earlier and later, and just wondering what it could be and how I can get to the root of the problem.
What are the symptoms? What are you seeing?
It starts with a white kind of fungus. It looks like it grows on just a couple leaves, and then the leaf starts to die off, and the fungus just seems to spread. And it takes about a month from the time I see the fungus at first until the plant is significantly damaged.
Yeah, this sounds like powdery mildew. And I think there are some good varieties that you could try because those definitely make a difference. Powdery mildew will start on the underside of the leaves or those squashes and cucumbers. And then when there is a lot of humidity, they will just cover it in like white powder. And the problem with that is then the leaves will become smaller and kind of the fruit, you know, if it forms, is very, very, you know, small and not as good. But I think that the variety will make a big difference. The spacing will make a big difference. And also avoiding any type of shade, like the most amount of sun that you can and the best aeration possible.
Okay. Is there a list somewhere that I could find the varieties that would be good?
What you might want to do is check some of the seed catalogs like Harris Seed, Johnny Seed, and they typically in their variety description will indicate if they're possibly tolerant of that, and I would check that.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Ann. 866-780-9100. Charlene is up next in Shell Rock. Hi, Charlene.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and I love this program.
Oh, so, thanks. What's your question?
My question is, I have a very established asparagus bed, and unfortunately, Creeping Charlie is creeping in. So what does one do?
Well, basically, one goes out and either hoes very shallow or hand pulls. Now, the good thing is that ground ivy or Creeping Charlie does not have a deep root system. So it is something that you can physically remove by hoeing or pulling. The other thing that I would do is make sure there's a nice clearing between the asparagus and the nearby grass. Because typically it spreads into area because it has this very rapid growing vining type growth habit. And so if it's in the grass, it very quickly kind of grows outward into adjacent areas. And so if you have that nice clean border around the asparagus, you can catch it there before it has a chance to get into the actual asparagus. So, but it's basically, it's basically hoeing very shallow so you don't disturb the actual asparagus and hand pulling.
I see a lot of good lessons for my children here, so thank you.
All right, great. Well, and let us know if that actually works. I've tried to teach some of those lessons myself. Good luck with that, Charlene. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, Michelle in Altoona. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This show is perfect for my question, I think. I have two maple trees, and they're about 2 years old. I noticed that as they're leaving out, the leaves are about, 2 inches wide. And there are little red bumps all over them. And they're raised like, I don't know if they're a bug or if they're a parasite or I don't know what they are. But I thought you could help me.
Yes, we can help. So those sound like the maple bladder gall. So I would look that up and see if that picture matches what you're seeing. And so it's like all galls on leaves of trees, they don't really cause any harm. They're kind of interesting looking, but they don't actually hurt the tree, the overall health of the tree. These are actually caused by a very, very tiny little mite that you aren't going to be able to see at all. And that mite feeding causes the leaf to actually form that red lump. So that's what you're seeing is actually part of the tree itself. So I always think that's pretty neat that the insects and mites can cause the tree leaves to make these really beautiful growths.
Yeah, they are kind of pretty, but I thought, oh dear. But so can you please say again what you called it? I didn't catch
it. Yeah, maple bladder gall.
With a G, gall?
Yep, G-A-L-L. Oh,
maple bladder gall. I'll look that up. Oh, thank you so much. And then one more quick question about my apple tree. Is it what is the best time to spray an apple tree?
It kind of depends upon it kind of depends upon the product. If you have a fairly common home orchard spray or home fruit tree spray, you're typically limited by those products to two applications per year. And so if I was going to spray, if I had that product, I would spray in mid-June and early July, and that would be the most effective time.
Okay. Okay, so before the apples come on.
Well, actually, when the apples are forming, right. The apples should be blooming, I would think, by this week, maybe, or early next week. And then until that harvest occurs, that apple is vulnerable to insect damage, but the most important time would be mid-June and early July.
Thank you so very much. Great show. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Michelle. You can call us, too. The number, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Let's do a couple of email questions here, by the way. The email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This one's from Susan. She says, we live near a busy parking lot, so we've put up a trellis fence so we can plant some climbing plants to give us a little bit of privacy on our patio. They are about 5 feet tall, and each panel is about 18 inches wide. The site is on the north side of the house, but gets full sun from east to west during the day. I've also been considering planting some beans or cucumbers to climb here. Could they live together happily with perennials?
Well, they could if they have enough space. Just make sure you could put in some beans, for example, edible beans or ornamental beans. But you could also put in some perennials like clematis. They do very well on a trellis, and they're also very attractive. So it could be something that is edible, or it could be something that's actually attractive.
All right. Any other perennials she might want to consider?
As far as perennials, climbing perennials, there aren't too many of those. There are some woody plants, but I think grapevines would be inappropriate. I would think that Virginia creeper would be inappropriate, but clematis fit very nicely.
All right. Here's another email question from Tom. I have two northern apricots that died this winter. Can I cut them down now and plant two contender peaches in their place?
You can, but I would also be a little bit cautious on that, too, because when you have temperatures that drop down to like 25 below zero, I think most peach cultivars, even contender, may not survive that type of winter. So they're kind of iffy also in this area. In
all right. And he also says he would prefer not to remove the apricot stumps, just hack holes in the ground next to the stumps to plant the new trees. What do you think about that?
You can move a few feet away, like 2 or 3 feet away, and do that. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if you cut down the dead tree, that maybe the root system might still be alive, and it may send up some suckers, and you may have to destroy those if they do.
All right. And given that these were apricot trees, if it sent up suckers, would we have a grafting situation? You wouldn't want to let those suckers grow?
Right. That would be from the rootstock, and that would not give you the desired variety, no.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Michael on the line in Sycamore, Illinois. Hello, Michael.
Yes. Good morning. I have been kind of suffering from blight on the tomato plants, and I'm curious if I should bring in new topsoil to put down over the garden, or if an option of planting the tomato plants through, say, a thin plastic to keep, you know, the water from getting up on top of the leaves. Just kind of wondering what my options are there. Thank you.
Yeah, so tomatoes get at least three different types of blights caused by three different fungi. The most common one that we get is the Septoria blight. It's the most samples that we get. And so with that one, the soil is not as important as a good sanitation in the fall. But also, as you train your tomatoes, making sure that, you know, you're picking up the bottom leaves that may start showing up the symptoms. Anything that you can do in terms of spacing will be very good. And also remind you that this particular, if it is the Septoria blight, it won't get on the fruit, on the tomato fruit. So it will be more of a matter of the size of the fruit that you will get. So I get it in my garden every year. I do a little bit of pruning in the base of the plant, a lot of aeration, and I'm okay with a little bit of a smaller fruit. I'm going to can anyway. So some things in there that you can try.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Bob in Tipton. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a bunch of berry bushes, and I layered some last summer, and I transplanted them this spring, early in the spring, and they're probably 8 to 10 inches tall, and they have blooms on them. And I was wondering if I should let the bloom stay and pull off their fruit, or would that retard their growth if they produce fruit so small and they're so small?
Yeah, I would be inclined to remove them. Typically, when you plant things like apples and pears, fruit trees, and other things, that you want them to get established well before you allow them to bear fruit. So I would be inclined to pinch them off.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Bruce is up next in Waterloo. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I probably need more information on this. This is something I observed from the bike trail. And on that, by Big Woods Lake, there were a number of trees, not big trees, but smaller trees, maybe 5, 6, 8 inches in diameter, that were totally stripped. And some of them I thought were just on one side. But then I got a little farther in there, and there was a number of them that was, the bark was stripped all the way from the ground up 10 or 15 feet. And I wondered if you had any clue, or do I need to go back and see what kind of trees they were that would give us an indication of what might be causing that?
Well, I would be, I'm kind of stumped on that. There are two things that commonly come to mind, but nothing 15 feet high. The rabbits will feed on trees during the winter months. And if you have very deep snow or snow drift, it might be quite high up on the plant. But they typically do that near the ground. And what they do is they basically eat down to the wood. And so you see that the area has been totally stripped of the bark. We also have deer in the fall, especially the bucks. They will rub their antlers on the trunks of small trees and remove the bark. So those two things happen fairly commonly in Iowa. But 15 feet high, I'm not sure what that would be offhand at all.
Yeah.
I wondered about that. Maybe it was rabbit standing on top of deer antlers.
Probably not. I will say sometimes squirrels will strip off pieces of bark, and they obviously can be very high in the tree, but that's not a very common problem, but they do it on occasion where they will strip off bark, and they can actually destroy certain trees when that happens, but it's a very rare thing for that to happen, but they will strip off bark occasionally.
Do they prefer younger, smaller trees?
I would think that they would, because it would come off easier, right? So on a larger tree, it would be on the branches. On a smaller tree, it could be the trunk.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Bruce. 866-780-9100. Lynn next in Iowa City. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have two azaleas that for 16 years bloomed regularly, no problems. Last year, they didn't bloom at all, and this year, only one had a few blossoms on the lower twigs. And they look healthy. They're putting out more leaves, but not blooming.
Okay. Do you know what type they are?
No, I don't. They were here when we moved in.
Okay. There's a couple of things that I would be concerned about. One is they have a very shallow root system. And so when we have some dry weather, they suffer fairly quickly. And the flower buds actually begin to form. The flower buds begin to form around midsummer. So if we're having some dry weather in July, August, September, I would make sure they have some water, because they need that water to go ahead and form some flower buds. So if they're under stress from drought, they may not form any flower buds. The other thing is you might want to give them a little bit of fertilizer in the spring. That's pretty good. I would just a small amount of nitrogen or possibly ammonium sulfate and put that on this spring. Make sure they have plenty of water. Another thing that sometimes happens is that sometimes they get some type of mildew where they get quite a bit of leaf drop. And if they experience leaf drop, again, they may not form very many flower buds. So if that is an issue, you may have to spray them with a fungicide. But if they're not doing that, that's not a problem.
Okay, they're not. They seem pretty healthy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's try to slip this question in quick from Pete. I was checking online about whether or not I should mulch over tulip bulbs and butterfly garden wildflower seeds, and a website indicated that straw in a garden, vegetable or flower, could introduce damaging herbicides. Is that something I need to be worried about?
It is something that can occur. You may want to ask as far as if you buy this, the source, and if they know they use some type of herbicide. There are some herbicides that can persist in the plant debris, and that can damage plants. You could also maybe use grass clippings from your lawn. They work very nicely, and if you're not using herbicide, that would be great.
All right, so find a source. If that's something you're really concerned about, find a source that wouldn't have the herbicides in it.
Right, right.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. I also have Laura Iles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at ISU, and Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, Plant Pathologist and Diagnostician at the clinic. They are here to answer your questions, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Laura Iles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, Plant Pathologist and Diagnostician with the clinic, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And let's get back to the phones. Next up, we've got Tim in Moline. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I have a tropical hibiscus that I've been putting out annually for many years. And last year, it just would not bloom. It would not bud at all. This year, it's overwintered beautifully in my home. I've had no leaf drop. It looks exceptionally healthy. But again, no sign of buds. I'm afraid I'm going to have a repeat. Is there something I should be doing?
Well, I think it's a little bit early on that. I think once you get it outside, once it's been properly acclimated, I would hopefully by maybe June or so that it starts to bloom. But there will be that acclimation period there when it has to get used to being outside. Make sure that you don't fertilize too much. If you fertilize excessively, that might discourage blooming. Try to keep the soil moist, give it plenty of sun, and I would hope by hopefully early to mid-June that you start to see some flowers.
So I used a slow-release fertilizer annually. Is it possible that I've built up too much in the soil and that prevented it from blooming last year?
Well, it's a possibility. I mean, if it's growing very rapidly.
Because I have great vegetative growth.
Okay, and if it's growing very quickly, rapidly, then maybe it is a case of too much fertilizer. I would tend to use maybe a water-soluble product where you can add a little bit to water and maybe do that every 2 or 4 weeks.
Okay, I'll try that this year. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Tim. Next up, we've got Brian in Iowa City. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
My question is about my raspberries that I transplanted about 2.5 years ago. And I'm wondering, I have an abundance of sawdust from my work, and can I use that for a mulch? And also, am I able to spray some sort of, not necessarily Roundup or weed preventer that won't ruin the raspberry crop?
Yeah, herbicides probably are not going to be something that you can use, but you can use the wood chips or the sawdust. I would probably put on a fairly light layer initially, maybe an inch or two, and then maybe over time you can add some more to that and come up with maybe a depth of 3 to 4 inches. But initially maybe 1 or 2 inches, make sure that it doesn't crust over. Sometimes when sawdust gets wet and dries, it will sometimes form a crust on the surface, and if it does, you have to kind of break that apart. But I would initially put on 1 or 2 inches, and then maybe later on in the summer maybe add another 1 or 2 inches. No more than 4 inches on the sawdust.
And to keep the weeds down, if they do poke through, he's just going to have to use manual control.
Right.
So pull them.
Right. Or dig them. Yes.
All right. Pull them or dig them. Although I know next to raspberries, that can be pretty tricky. Be careful.
Right.
All right. Tim is up next in Leland. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I've got a grass problem, a fungus or a moss in my grass. And I was wondering if there's anything I can do to get rid of it. I've taken it out with a fork, and that's really tedious. Good. See if you could help me. Thank you.
Right. Well, moss is fairly common in lawns and gardens, especially this year, because last year we had so much rain, and moss loves damp, moist conditions, and also shade. So if you have those conditions, moss is very common. The moss is not killing the grass, but if the grass is kind of thin, if you have open spaces, moss will occupy those open spaces. Moss will grow almost anywhere. So as far as dealing with it, moss doesn't really have a root system per se. You can kind of rake it right up. Comes up fairly easily. But if the environmental conditions are favorable, it's going to be back. What you might want to do possibly is if you have a lot of shade, because that's not good for grass, what you might want to do maybe is go out in mid-August and rake off any moss that you have, and then possibly go ahead and core aerate the yard where you pull out plugs of soil, and then go ahead and sow grass seed and make sure it's a shade-tolerant grass mix, things like creeping red fescue, hard fescue, chewings fescue. Go ahead and sow the grass seed and then drag the area with a mat or maybe a rake, and then that should work the seed into the soil, and it should come up, and then you should have a better stand of grass. If you have a better stand of grass, the moss won't come back.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call, Tim. And next, we'll go to Barb in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Charity. Hey, I have a quick question about a young maple. It was planted professionally about 2.5 years ago, and I noticed that the leaves in the lower part are doing really well. But I'm noticing at the very top, they're coming in a little bit more slowly. And I want to make sure that the tree's okay. It has full sun, and I just know we've gotten a lot of rain. But is that normal? Is it going to be okay?
That's not normal. It's not a lost cause at this point. That would seem to suggest the tree is kind of struggling. You probably can't do a whole lot. One thing that I definitely would do is if we have some dry periods this summer, make sure you water periodically, maybe once every 10 to 14 days, really soak the tree. Make sure that no damage occurs to it as far as lawnmowers hitting the trunk, that type of thing. And hopefully over time it does better. But the fact the tree is leafing out a little bit late on the top would suggest the tree is having some problems getting established.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because last year I always made sure to water it. I gave it, they gave me root feed, and I did that, you know, when I can't remember how often it was that I was supposed to do that. But, I mean, it has the leaves at the top. They're just not opening up as fast as the ones at the bottom.
Right. But maybe they will. So it's a little bit early yet. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't panic at this point. I would be concerned, okay. But I wouldn't panic. So, and as far as watering it, I would water by watering on the surface. I wouldn't use like a root feeder or any type of device like that. Just water on the surface.
Okay. Well, I wasn't really clear. It was a root feed. It was like a root promoting feed that for the first year and a half, I think they, so, you know, I know it got a good start. It has a nice mulch bed around it, so
that's
the lawnmower doesn't come near.
That's great.
So,
well, it sounds like you're doing all the right things, Barb. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Yep. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Jim is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
How are we doing today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I've had a problem. I planted a cherry tree a good decade ago, and it took forever to bloom and fruit out. But the last 2 or 3 years, they've had tons of blooms, and the cherries come out, and then they all turn black and shrivel up, and that's what I get for the last couple, 3 years.
Bummer.
I don't know what it is.
Everybody's super excited
to answer this question. I'm thinking it's brown rot, would be my guess on the prunus. It's a fairly common thing. It looks like kind of a brownish fuzz grows on the surface of the actual fruit. Lena?
Yeah, I think that that sounds, it's very common in the pathogen. It's a fungal pathogen that can stay on the wood. And so when it's time to, you know, come back, it just, you know, find the fruit and starts making like this fuzzy look on it.
And to control that, you would typically want to remove any mummies.
Yes.
These dried up fruit that may be on the ground, if you can rake those up and get rid of them. And also you would have all to use a fungicide beginning very early in the spring of the year.
Yep.
Now, would that be your garden variety fruit tree spray?
I think Captan probably would take care of that. I would check the label to make sure on that.
And just a quick note.
I've sprayed it already this year, but I tried that last year, and they all still did the same thing. That's why I was calling to get any better tips.
Yeah, and the fungicide is not going to work on its own. The sanitation is very, very important, because if you don't remove those mummies and anything that is in the bottom of the tree and on the tree still hanging, then you're still going to have that problem recurrent.
Okay, and the things you say are on the tree, are they actually like insects or something? Or
No, they're the fruit that's fallen.
Yeah, the dried fruit are called mummies, and they will fall to the ground, and they're very small, but if they remain there, they serve as a source for the next year's infection.
So, and what about the ones that are still on the tree from last year?
If you can pull those off, if you can pull those off, that would be beneficial too. Absolutely.
Well, then that's what I'll do. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Jim. Is Jim in trouble if he didn't do that in the fall? Is he already going to have trouble this spring, this year?
Yeah, I think, well, it depends on where he's at, but I think he still has some time to get them out, because the important part will be when the fruit starts forming. And unfortunately, if the pathogen may have reached the wood, then the story will be different. But anything that he can do to just pick up those mummies will definitely help.
Okay, so start now and just keep going. So if it happens again this year, he needs to get on it right away. That happens, right? Okay.
Yep.
Good luck, Jim. I hope that gets worked out. Let's do a couple email questions here. This one's from Jason in Humboldt. My phlox plants are about 2/3 dead brown and only partly green. Should I trim off the brown material back to the green areas? Will they grow back? They were once large, nice, and green.
Okay, that's a large number of plants belong to that genus. Typically, I wouldn't expect to see a lot of dieback at this point, but if there are certain areas that are brown or dead, I would definitely remove that portion or those portions.
Yeah, right. And I will look for if there is any type of fussy look on the underside of the leaves, because the phloxes do get downy mildew, and this is the perfect weather for it.
All right, here is a question from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. We have two established milkweed plants out front, and we'd like to expand coverage. We were given some milkweed seeds, but forgot to put them in the freezer, and I fear it's far too late to get them into the ground for this season. Is there anything I can do other than going and purchasing several milkweed plants and adding them to my lawn?
I think you could probably try some of those seeds and see if you get some sprouting. You can start them indoors even now and see if you get some sprouts from them.
Right. Typically, we get better germination if they are exposed to some cold temperatures over a few weeks, but they could still try. But they can also buy some very nice plants at the garden center. Butterfly weed is a very, very attractive plant, and it does attract monarchs.
All right. And there are also seed packets available. Would those have already been exposed to cold and maybe a good option?
They may have been, yes.
Okay. And common milkweed is pretty good at growing.
Oh, yes. It's very good at growing.
All right. I haven't had any trouble getting mine going. So, but I know that the butterfly weed is a lot prettier. Also, here's one from Kevin. Should I be concerned about my blood good Japanese maples? They haven't leafed out yet. Scraping shows green color, but buds don't look viable. What do you think?
Yes, I would be concerned, because we had this very cold winter. Japanese maples are kind of marginally hardy in Iowa. I wouldn't give up hope at this point yet, but they're going to have to leaf out. And if they haven't leafed out by the end of May, they may have lost the plant, I'm afraid.
All right. And also, Kevin asks, what is your go-to mulch for tomatoes? Is pine bark mulch okay? What shouldn't we use?
I use grass clippings. I think they're great. They're free. You can collect them and use them. They do a very nice job as far as the mulch.
All right, here's a question from Roger. He wants to know how to prepare seed potatoes. Does he have to let them sit out after cutting and before planting?
We typically do for a day or two. We do that because when they cut those, that surface is very, very wet. And if we plant those immediately and we have some very cold or cool weather and it's very, very wet, that surface may tend to rot. If we just put them in a box and maybe put a piece of paper over them, keep them at room temperature, they kind of seal over or form callus. And so once we do that, they're less likely to rot.
All right, let's go back to the phones. George is on the line in Guthrie Center. Hi, George.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. 12 years ago, I started seven sea berry. They're called buckhorn, sea buckhorns, and they're male and female bushes or trees. And today they're 10 feet tall, and every year they have flowers, but there's never one sea berry. So apparently I have all the same sex. And so my question is, how do I tell the difference between a male and female sea berry?
To be perfectly honest, I don't recall their flowering habit. As far as do they have male and female plants or do they need cross-pollination, I'm not sure on that. You say they flower?
Yes, I am sure on that one. Yes,
okay.
Yes, that's the case.
The flower structure is a little bit different. There's just very small differences. One would produce pollen, and one would tend to have a structure in the center of the flower that is sticky. And so the male has the pollen-producing structures, and then the female would have this sticky structure in the center of the flower that would basically catch the pollen and then form the fruit. So that's the difference between the two. These are probably very small flowers, so the difference may not be that clear, but if you look closely, you should see the difference.
Okay.
All right, yeah.
Thank you.
Good luck with that, George. Thanks a lot for your call, and we are nearly out of time. Let's try to squeeze in one more question here. Let's go to Tom in Iowa City. Hi, Tom.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have a 35-year-old lilac bush that is all leafed out and it looks good, but there's not a hint on it anywhere of any flowering this year. I don't know if the extreme cold did something to it or if it's just taking the year off.
Well, no, I don't think it should. Lilacs are really tough, resilient plants, so the cold weather shouldn't have harmed them. Did it bloom well last year?
Sorry, I put him on hold because we're almost out of time.
I would do is, if it did bloom well last year, I think what I would do is maybe go out and remove maybe 3, 4, or 5 of the oldest, largest stems near the ground and encourage some new growth, and that new growth hopefully will bloom in later years.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for your call, and we are out of time. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Laura Iles, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
And Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, thank you.
Happy to be here.
Laura Iles and Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. And if you'd like to learn more about their services, you can find them on their website. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.